The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, time to go into the vault for an older episode of the show. This one originally published on December 27th, 2022, and Rob, it is an interview you did with Ian Livingstone.
Livingstone, yes. Livingstone. Yeah, this was a fun one that I did last year, I think during like the holiday seasons when, you know, some folks were out and trying to line up some chats, and yeah, this is a... One of the creators of Games Workshop, and he has his hands and his mind and so many other games and just like game systems in general. So this was a really fun chat, and I'm excited to share it with everyone again.
Let's jump right in.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb, and today I'd like to present an interview I recorded earlier this month with Sir Ian Livingstone, co-founder of Games Workshop and co-author of the Fighting Fantasy Gamebook series. Now, the creations to come out of Games Workshop especially have meant so much to me over the years, and it was a real honor to chat with him about the early days of Games Workshop, about old school gaming in general, the meaning of games, and of course his new book, Dice Men, The Origin Story of Games Workshop, which he wrote with Steve Jackson. The book is out now digitally, and the physical version is either out or available for pre-order depending on what region you're in. Either way you get it, pick it up. It's a great read. It has so many wonderful images in it. It really transport you back in time. It tells a great tale. So without further ado, let's jump right into the interview. Hi, Ian. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to speak to you today.
So the book is Dice Men, The Origin Story of Games Workshop, written with Steve Jackson. And I think at this point, a great number of our listeners out there are certainly well acquainted with the name Games Workshop. Even if you didn't grow up with the games and the miniatures like I did and like many others did, you're still going to probably be aware of like all the novels, the video games, the animated series, and so much more. It's big business. But I thought you might take us back and just in brief, remind us what Games Workshop was back in the day when you and Steve Jackson co-founded it.
Well, Steve and I were old school friends, and we met up in London in the 70s, and our passion was playing board games, mainly those that came from the US, games like Diplomacy and Avalon Hill games. And we thought, wouldn't it be great if we could somehow turn our passion of playing games into some sort of fledgling business? So we decided to publish a small fanzine called Owl and Weasel, and we sent one copy to everybody we knew in games. And although we hadn't sent it to him directly, one found its way to the desk of Gary Gygax in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And Gary wrote to us and said, love your little fanzine. Here's this game I've just published and designed. What do you think? And that game was Dungeons & Dragons. And whilst it didn't look much, pretty plain box with a very ordinary illustration on the cover, It opened up your imagination like no game had ever done before, and I don't think any game ever will again, in that it allowed a new form of interactive entertainment, role-playing, people playing as heroes and wizards, exploring the labyrinths designed by Games Master, and through theatre on the fly, conversing and creating this incredible narrative story between the players as they forged their way through the dungeons, killing monsters and finding treasure. So we ordered 6 copies of D&D because that's all the money we actually had in our lives. And on the back of that order, Gary gave us a 3-year exclusive distribution agreement for the whole of Europe. So we were effectively all playing as role-playing people about a role-playing game. It was very amateurish, but that's how things started in the 70s.
Yeah, it was fascinating to read your take on the gaming world prior to the creation of Games Workshop and prior to the introduction and creation of Dungeons & Dragons. Just how niche was gaming beyond family staples like Monopoly during the 1960s, for example?
Well, in the UK, there was one company dominated, that was Waddington's, and they published Monopoly, Cluedo, which is Clue in the US, Buccaneer, and Formula One. And these games were enjoyable enough, but they were never satisfied gamers like Steve and myself. We wanted something more where there's more strategy than luck, and where you could do negotiations and have a kind of a meta level of enjoyment by all the bargaining and reneging on deals that could happen. Obviously, diplomacy is perfect for that kind of play where you can mm-hmm. backstab people at will in order to dominate the world. So those are the games we looked out for, but D&D really changed our minds of the type of game we want to play. We were suddenly immersed in this incredible fantasy world and a kind of Tolkien-esque world of monsters and magic, going on these fantastic journeys of the mind through conversation. And it was that theater of the fly that I just mentioned that became a place where we wanted to visit all the time.
Are you saying that it also, Dungeons and Dragons, sort of opened up the space for fantasy itself to be part of gaming? Because you describe a lot of the gaming prior to that is very like historical military based, right?
Yeah, the miniatures companies in the UK in particular were all based on Napoleonics, ancients, and some World War II. But there was no fantasy element as such, even though fantasy was pretty well established in UK mythology from George and the Dragon or Arthurian Knights, and of course the books from Tolkien and others. So I guess it was no surprise that fantasy gaming would ultimately come along as a viable genre to enjoy play.
Yeah, you described that even Dungeons and Dragons kind of arises out of Chainmail, this military battle game that Gary Gygax had co-created, right?
Yeah, but he had this fantasy supplement. And when he played Dave Arneson's Blackmoor, there was that fusion of the two coming together to create, you know, this milestone in gaming history that is Dungeons and Dragons. But it was largely down, I think, to Gary's making it happen that it was as successful mm-hmm. as it was. Clearly, Dave Arneson had kind of probably conceived the original role-playing concept in a fantasy world as a result of his previous gaming experiences, but it's Gary who made it happen. He took what was largely in Dave Arneson's head and turned it into a 50-page rule book and then began the commercialization of that. So he was the driving force behind it.
So you mentioned earlier, you know, you had like the family games, and then you mentioned like the Avalon Hill games that were coming
yeah.
in. Now, was there just kind of like a big gap in complexity between, say, the Avalon Hill games and the family games? Was there not much in between?
There wasn't really. It was kind of full-on hobby gamers, hex grid, long and sometimes difficult to understand rules, which were the war games, and particularly SPI war games, and most of the Avalon Hill games. And then there was kind of, on the other side of the fence, this almost too easy to play. So we wanted something in the middle. And whilst that was something that we solved through playing Dungeons & Dragons, we also, as Games Workshop, started publishing our own board games to fill that, what we thought was a viable gap for kind of mid-core gaming experiences. Games like Talisman, Judge Dredd, Battle Cars, Apocalypse, and others that we published under Workshop's brand, as well as publishing Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, I remember as a child, before I became exposed to many of these other games, before being exposed to Dungeons and Dragons and Games Workshop games, we had family games in the household. My father had some of those SPI games, and I remember wanting to understand them and play them, but as a child, I just was completely overwhelmed by everything I found in the box.
Well, not only were the rule books completely lengthy and like you need to be kind of a Philadelphia lawyer to understand them, just setting up the counters would take hours as well, and not left any time for actually playing. I mean, some games like 1914 would last for days if you allowed it mm-hmm. to. So it was almost like work rather than play sometimes.
now, on the subject of miniatures and miniature war games, until very recently, I really didn't know how far back it went. I think I saw, and this isn't tremendously old, but I saw some wonderful footage of the late actor Peter Cushing painting miniature soldiers and plotting out battles with like historical-based Napoleonic figures. Is this pretty much what it consisted of prior to your work?
Well, over 100 years ago, there was lead miniatures put out there, a kind of 54 millimeter scale rather than 25 millimeter that we did through typical wargaming and fantasy gaming miniatures of our time. But they were mainly historical figures that people collected and sometimes fought battles. I mean, if you go back to Edwardian times, there were many companies actually producing lead figures, which were painted. And so I think toy soldiers is nothing new. It's just that toy soldiers that we made at Citadel Miniatures were 99% fantasy figures rather than historical war game figures.
Can you describe a little bit how Citadel Miniatures came together as part of or auxiliary to Games Workshop?
Yes, well, we'd been running workshops since 1975. We decided to up our game in terms of publishing, so we dropped Owl and Weasel, our little fanzine, and started publishing White Dwarf magazine, and we started running conventions, Games Day. It's one of those conventions that Brian Ansell, who was running a company called Asgard Miniatures at the time, we met him briefly there. We were also ordering quite a lot of giant rats and other figures from him that could be used in D&D games, and he requested a meeting with us. And so we met him in 78, and he said, I can be the answer to your miniatures problem, because at that time we were importing most of our games from the US, from Ralph Arthur in particular, and Archive Miniatures. And they were obviously very expensive to import, with not just the shipping costs, but the import duty costs. And then the delivery times were also a nightmare. So the logistics of the supply chain was a bit challenging. So we agreed that we'd set up a company with him, and we call that company Citadel Miniatures, but it was based in where he lived in the Midlands around Nottingham, and that's how Citadel came to be. And it became, just an amazing additive to the Games Workshop remit, which had historically just been publishing board games and opening retail shops.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product, and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
And as things keep moving with the miniatures, how does it grow in terms of the miniatures' role in the games? Because I mean, nowadays with Games Workshop, or at least for me, like I think about the games and the minis, and it's like it's very hard to differentiate between the two. But it sounds like from what I read in the book, like at times that is kind of a struggle to decide, even in the early days of Games Workshop, like what is the area that should be receiving the most attention, the miniatures or the games? Like, what is the interaction between these two areas?
Well, Steve and I were running the games division effectively. So we wanted to put more resource into publishing board games, publishing more role-playing games, opening more shops, publishing more magazines, as well as White Dwarf. So it's all around the kind of print media and retail division, whereas Brian Ansell was running Citadel Miniatures, wanted more resources allocated to more miniatures. And he had a great point, because the gross margin in miniatures was quite high. And he also argued that there should be a set of rules that enabled more miniatures to be sold, because if you're making miniatures for role-playing game, you tend to sell them in single units, because you only need one beholder or one skeleton or one cleric or one fighter. So really, that's how the Warhammer concept came about, as a way to sell units of miniatures rather than single figures. At the same time, at the end of 1978, we lost the exclusivity with Dungeons & Dragons. Now, Gary Gygax, as I said earlier, had given us a three-year exclusive distribution agreement, which ended at the end of 78 and the beginning. And then in 79, he came to visit us and said that he wanted to merge his company, TSR, with our company, Games Workshop, and we would be given a kind of third of the combined entity. But Steve and I were kind of independently minded young Brits at the time, and we didn't want to have a split life between London and Wisconsin. So we said no to that merger opportunity. So whilst we remained the biggest distributors of Dungeons & Dragons and TSR Hobbies games, we're no longer the exclusive distributor. And it was only a matter of time before they had set up in the UK and have their own distribution points, and we might obviously be that would obviously impact on our sales. So we knew we needed something that was going to be our own intellectual property. We determined our own destiny and our future, but it had to be something that could resonate with a wide audience and be able to scale. So whilst we had some considerable success with some of the board games that we published, another role-playing games that we published under license, like Traveller and RuneQuest, and imported games like Call of Cthulhu, it wasn't really until Warhammer came about that we were suddenly in a much better place in terms of being able to be independent. And it was the original idea from Brian Ansell to publish a kind of free set of rules as a giveaway with the mail orders. But then he brought in Rick Priestley and Richard Halliwell to kind of beef up the rules, and when they were played, it was decided, well, rather than just giving them away, let's make this into a product itself. And that's how Warhammer, the original fantasy battle game, came out in 1983. And even though it was loaded with errors and mistakes and wasn't particularly complete, it sold out very quickly. Some 3,000 copies went, you know, pretty much immediately. So that's how the the second edition of Warhammer came about. And then they realized that, you know what, if this is our own IP, we should focus more on it rather than other people's products. Mm-hmm. And therefore, Warhammer was really, was that became front and central focus for the whole of the company. So all the rules enabled more minutes to be sold. White Dwarf then focused down on Warhammer. The retail stores were selling less of imported products and more of our own products. And that slow move over happened over quite a few months before it became a totally Warhammer-focused company.
Now, in the book, you describe the first Space Marine minis that come about, and there are some lovely photographs as well. I have to stress for anyone out there who's interested in the book, there are so many wonderful photographs and scans as well of some of these early magazine publications and early editions of White Dwarf. It's fabulous, like a scrapbook.
Well, I like to think as a personal memoir with as much historical, photographic, and image reference as possible, and it's more of a personal biography, warts and all, and full of anecdotes rather than a book about business, and that's why there are over 400 photographs in the book, some a lot of which had never been seen before, rummaging around in the roof, and it's, in the loft looking for old 35 millimeter transparencies, slides that we had to have scanned, and getting really excited looking at slides you hadn't seen for some 45 years is just is an amazing experience in itself. And then writing more and more, and then talking to more colleagues to validate what we'd said, and remembering all this weird stuff that happened, like having to live in a van for 3 months because you couldn't get any bank finance. You're going to see the bank manager, tell him about Dungeons and Dragons. And he looks like you're mad and asks you to leave. So we had to finance everything out of cash flow, and could only afford to rent a very small office at the back of an estate agent, and had to live in Steve's van throughout 3 months of an awful winter. But I think I said in the book, you could call it living the dream, but clearly it wasn't. But when you're driven by passion around your own hobby, it doesn't seem like hardship.
The van in question, this is Van Morrison, correct? That was the nickname.
The one and only Van Morrison, yes. The big blue van. That was our home for 3 months.
Yeah, the personal stories are such a wonderful aspect of the book. Again, all these photographs of the real people involved in these games and in Games Workshop. It really beefs up the personal story. And then you have these little so many of these anecdotes and sort of little adventures that pop up along the way.
Yeah, like going to the States to see Carrie in 1976 to, in theory, attend Gen Con 9. But taking like 2 months to get there, and delivering cars from New York to LA, then another one from LA to San Francisco, and then one from to Chicago, and all the adventures we had along the route. It was a year of the Olympics year, and McDonald's were running this promotion where if the US won a gold medal, you won a Big Mac, and then if they won a silver medal, you get a large fries, and a bronze, you get a Coke. And so we were being kind of pretty patriotic by wanting the US to win all these medals, because if you had a ticket that matched the winning sport, you'd win one of the items. So that kept us alive on the road.
And this is was this also the trip where you went through Vegas?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I that part was very interesting as well, in part because you're describing like taking a jaunt through the casinos there and in a way kind of witnessing gaming or at its worst, at its kind of like crushing worst, whilst you and your cohorts are kind of on this like mission of passion and you've been describing like just being so inspired by these new ideas and then these new game possibilities that are emerging.
Yeah, it was. I think Vegas is an amazing place if you go there for a few days. But to see people losing their money, one particular gentleman from Japan, it was a bit sad to see his $100 bills disappear so quickly. So we didn't dare gamble a penny because we just couldn't afford it.
So how long did this process of going back and sort of piecing together the story the early Games Workshop days, trying to find these various photographs. Like, how long did it take to put all this together?
Well, I thought it was going to take about 6 months, and I think it took nearly 4 years because it wasn't just the process of doing it. It's doing it in times when I was free, because even though I'm nearly 73 years old, I'm still very much working full time on various projects. Still writing Final Fantasy game books in which you are the hero, the branching narrative with the game system attached. It's the 40th anniversary this year, and I wrote a new book to celebrate that, Shadows of the Giants, which was great to go back to my roots in that respect. And I also have my own school in Bournemouth, which is all around digital creativity and good arts education using game-based learning, and very much influenced by Dungeons & Dragons, the power of play, as it were. And as I mentioned, I'm also a general partner in Hero Capital, which is a venture capital fund investing in video games, studios and technologies. So it's a question of finding the time. And then the more I spent researching and writing, the more I wanted it to be as good it could possibly be. And so I went the extra mile, so to speak, to try and tell the full story and make sure what I said was validated by cross-referencing in magazines and talking to the people who were around at the time. Sadly, some of those people have since passed away, but nevertheless, I think it's a pretty accurate recount of those origin story years of 75 to 85.
Yeah, and I have to stress to everyone out there, you don't have to be like a game designer or just to be like a really hardcore gaming fan to find the story engaging. You know, it's ultimately the story of people and their passions.
Yes, I say it's. I'd like to see it almost like a coffee table book where you can just casually look at the images of the time, the fashions, and the things we did in the 70s and early 80s. But also, if you're curious, you know, read some of the story behind what became an incredible company, now worth some $3 billion on the London Stock Exchange, and also perhaps be amused by some of the anecdotes told in the story.
Now, you mentioned the Fighting Fantasy game book series, and I definitely wanted to ask you about that. I picked up the Warlock of Firetop Mountain prior to this interview, and I was playing through it with my son a bit, and tremendous fun encountering crocodiles and piranhas and goblins and so forth, and very, very captivating for both of us. And I think he was almost getting a little too into it, concerned about the danger we were encountering. He's 10, but this idea of the game book, what is the world of game books prior to your work with game books, and then what is the process like of laying these out and creating one that works? Because I definitely remember as a younger person picking up a game book by someone else. It was another company, a competitor, I imagine. And it was heartbreaking when it broke. It reached a point where I could not go any further because there was some sort of number error in the publication.
Right. Well, I believe Fighting Fantasy was the very first game book series which had a branching narrative and a game system attached to it. Around about the same time, although we hadn't seen them on this side of the Atlantic, the Choose Your Own Adventure books were out, but they were more choose your own paragraph. There was no game element to making. So what we tried to do with Fighting Fantasy was distill a role-playing experience into a single player solo adventure, whereby the book replaced the games master and you, the reader, move from a passive reading experience into an interactive experience by making choices. So it's that empowerment, because you are the hero. At the end, there are 400 paragraphs. At the end of each one, you have to make a choice. Simplistically, do you turn left or right? And then there are puzzles to solve, there are monsters to fight. That's when you use the dice, the three basic characteristics, skill, stamina, and luck, which are modified through your progress through the adventure. Your skill might go up if you find a magic potion, or your stamina might go down if you lose a fight in combat with a monster. And then you test your luck to escape or try and get extra benefits by rolling dice against your luck roll. So we wanted to have a very thrilling experience for people, that giving the agency through choice is empowering, and they were hugely successful. They went on to sell over 20 million copies globally. And they got a whole generation of children reading in the 80s because of that, the agency, that empowerment was very compelling, and they spread by word of mouth. Clearly, there was no internet at the time, but it was the word of mouth, which is the best kind of virality you could possibly hope for in the playgrounds of the schools initially in the UK, and then it spread into Europe and ultimately globally. And so Wolkafai Top Mountain, as you read, was the first one. And we wanted to use our own artists that we'd use at Games Workshop, because we found those really stimulated children's imagination because they were realistically detailed. Whereas Puffy were a bit nervous about it, the imprint, because they, as they were children's books, they wanted nice, safe covers with, you know, little toadstool, little gnome sitting on the toadstool, and butterflies in the air. Whereas we really wanted the kids to be kind of go, oh my goodness, what is that horrendous creature coming at me? It's going to bite my head off. So we wanted that kind of thrill of excitement. And then the joy of them, you know, succeeding by getting through the books. So finding a key in one room allows you to open a chest or door further on in the adventure. But writing them, as you say, was an absolute nightmare. It was like writing multiple storylines at once and having to bring the readers back to certain common points, node points, where they had to have essential information to allow them to progress. You had to balance the economy so it wasn't too much gold or too little gold. You had to make sure it wasn't too difficult or too easy, so it was a fun experience, but with enough of a challenge, but not impossible. Make sure there were no cul-de-sacs and all the choice you make. So we designed them on a flow chart, really, as like a computer flow chart, making sure every split in the adventure was notated and what could be found or not found at each decision point. But the important thing is that every decision had to have a consequence. Otherwise, why have it branching anyway? So it was really good fun. And of course, my joy was to lure people to their doom, promise them wealth and glory with nice rose petals along the pathway, only for them to fall on poison spikes down a pit, which was always good fun for me. But of course, most people cheated. Had their fingers multiple pages in the book, and you could see them on public transport, on buses and trains, with their fingers in about five places in the book. So it always used to make me laugh when I see that. I used to see that in those days.
I love the innovation of it. You mentioned the dice that are used, like a couple of D6, but I love the innovation of the dice at various dice combinations at the bottom of each page that you can flip through if you don't have physical dice and do a dice roll.
That was a more recent adaptation innovation in the original books, which were much more highly detailed in their illustrations and perhaps more threatening. It didn't have the dice roll, so yeah, I guess that's...
It would have made it easier for playing it on the train, I guess.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential, and then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own? Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hey, guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Now, you mentioned computer games. The games like the Warlock of Firetop Mountain and these other game books you worked on, these have eventually found their way into the world of computer gaming, right?
They did. I mean, Dice Man doesn't really cover too much about video games, except for what we did at the time in the early 80s, selling Activision games and very early PCs and console gaming, just when there was an early crash in the early 80s, which had quite a negative impact on Games Workshop for the amount of stock we had at retail. But more recently, Final Fantasy game books have been available digitally from Tin Man Games in Australia, who've designed them as apps, and Nomad Games have created games on Switch and also on PC, which is more of a top-down kind of, not a collectible car game, but being rewarded with cars when you progress through the adventure and ultimately get through. So Death Trap Dungeon, City of Thieves, Forest of Doom have all been ported to digital formats. So there's something for everyone these days, books or video games.
One thing I was wondering about as well is that, you know, obviously we have this, you know, the rich world of miniature-based games and Dungeons and Dragons, various role-playing games, and these game books as well. And in the background, or in the forefront, depending on how you look at it, I guess, we have the emergence of even more video game opportunities. And today, we have, you know, some pretty amazing video games out there. The graphics are better than ever before. The game systems involved are so complicated. But we as gamers of all ages, we keep coming back we're coming back to these game books. We're coming back to physical tabletop games and to games that take place predominantly in our imagination. What does that mean, you think?
I don't think one is at the expense of the other. I think it's nice to you know, I play both board games. I'm sitting in a room here, you might see, with over 1,500 board games in the room, but I also have, you know, hundreds of video games. I think it depends how you feel on the day. And you can also see that vinyl has made a revival. People don't just want to stream music to whatever digital device they have. They like to have the physicality. Physical books have made a revival because people like to surround themselves with things that give them pleasure. The physical, as well as the digital, I think helps satisfy all parts of the human mind rather than one at the expense of the other. So I enjoy both. It depends of who I'm going to play with or what I'm going to read and in what format I happen to be using at the time. If I'm traveling, obviously it's going to be digital. If I'm at home, probably physical.
Now I'm going to come back to something I was going to ask earlier, and we ended up going in a different direction, but you described the first Space Marine minis in the book, and there's some lovely photographs of the little minis as well. The Space Marines of Warhammer 40,000 have certainly become, you know, very iconic. They're a very recognizable part of the brand, and yeah, Clearly big business as well. How did this concept originally come together?
Well, they've changed an awful lot over time, from the Space Marines of the 80s to the Space Marines of today. They've just got bigger, bolder and stronger, and have got an incredible aesthetic around them now, of course, and everyone loves them. They came from very humble beginnings. I think it was Bob Naismith who came up with the original Space Marine look and feel in his iconic first miniature. So I call things small, like acorns. They become oaks over time, given the right environment for growth through their popularity. So it's great to see them so amazingly successful today, and this, the power of Warhammer 40k is extraordinary. I think there's some, talking to about video games, I think there's some 50 licenses now and some extraordinary games being put out there. So yeah, the world of Warhammer is rich and famous and widespread.
Now obviously there's a lot to say about about game design and approaches to game design and the business of game design and the business of gaming. Do you have any quick advice to throw out there to anyone who is a budding game designer or thinks they want to get into the industry of game design?
Well, I guess it depends on what part of the industry you want to get into. Is it tabletop wargaming? Is it board games? Is it video games? The thing that unites them all, when people ask me what's the three most important things about a game, I will say gameplay, gameplay, gameplay. In video games, whilst technology and graphics are essential, they play a supporting role. It always comes down to how you're enjoying the game to play rather than what things look like. But in a board game, of course, great production values has really enhanced that experience now with all the bits, and the graphics are amazing now. But the gameplay is what makes us want to start playing in the first place. So games should be quick to learn but difficult to master, so you can get various degrees of expert abilities in these games. So the better player you are, you should be more successful in winning. And of course, you need an exciting theme that resonates with everybody. I mean, in board games, and it's no surprise that Ticket to Ride has been successful. You can learn it very quickly, but it takes a long time to become a master of it, really, all the strategies. It looks great. The trains resonate with everybody. The pieces are lovely because you pick up these little train carriers and plot them around the board. So it's kind of got all the component parts of a classically successful game. And similarly with video games, the appeal has to be in the gameplay. And then the meta level, of course, that's a common denominator about all these, is the enjoyment caused by people playing together. So it's that joy by anything that is a shared experience is always enhanced. And it's always an enhanced experience, whether it's looking at a sunset or having dinner or going to the cinema with somebody. And obviously with games, you're playing with somebody that fun that's created by just the conversation, whether it's the shared experience of enjoyment or doing a deal and reneging on it, that's adds that extra level of enjoyment. So there are many things to consider when designing a game, but there's four basic principles I think is absolutely vital to include.
Now, you mentioned earlier all the activities you're involved in. You and of course you're a legend in the game design industry. Do you still gather with friends and just play games purely recreationally?
We play once a week.
All right.
With the same group of people since the 80s. So still Steve Jackson, plus Peter Molyneux from the video games industry, one of the UK's premier designers. I mean, he created Populous originally, and Fable, and Black and White, and other amazing video games titles. And it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek gentleman's club in that we play games and keep a record of all the games played every week, and score points. And I send out a newsletter, the Games Night newsletter, largely just to criticize the other people playing, and allows me as secretary to treat it as my own, kind of give them verbal abuse the whole time. At the end of the year, we have a cup, the Pagoda Cup, that's presented to the champion. So we don't take ourselves seriously about doing it, but it adds another dimension to playing the games that we do. So we've been doing it for, say, since the 80s, I've published 627 issues of the Games Night newsletter to a circulation of six people.
So coming back to the book for a second, again, the book is Dice Men, The Origin Story of Games Workshop. We talked a little bit about how it came together, but why did it come together? Why now? Why 2022?
Well, I started writing it about 4 years ago, largely because Games Workshop was doing so well as a company. Everyone was saying, what is this games company on the London Stock Exchange that's now worth $3 or $4 billion? That's ridiculous. How can it be worth more than some of the major corporations I've known all my life? Where did it come from? And when I meet people, I said, what was your first? How do you get into games? I said, well, I started a company called Games Workshop. And I said, well, how did that come about? So I thought, you know what? It really is about time. This was put down in writing as a kind of a personal memoir. And and something that could be there for posterity long after I've gone and Steve's gone. It would be there for people who might be remotely interested in what has been an incredible journey, the kind of birth of the game industry in the UK and globally. Really, it was such an amateurish thing in the 70s, but to see that down on paper and won't be lost forever, I thought was an important thing to do. So there we are. Life is a game for us.
Well, it's a great read. I highly recommend it to our listeners. And I want to thank you for coming on the show. And I also want to just thank you for, helping to bring about all these great creations that mean so much to us. I mean, the Warhammer 40,000, these are things that still bring me a lot of joy today as an adult, and certainly gave me a lot of joy when I first discovered them as a kid.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say that. I mean, for me as a games player, to have been able to work in games for 47 years has been an absolute privilege and a joy. So thank you.
Thank you. Thanks once more to Sir Ian for taking time out of his day to chat with me here. It was a real pleasure. Again, the book is Dice Men, The Origin Story of Games Workshop, written with Steve Jackson. You can find that wherever you get your books. I highly recommend checking it out and picking it up. Just a reminder that core episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind publish on Tuesdays and Thursdays, with a listener mail episode on Mondays, a short form monster fact or artifact episode on Wednesdays, and on Fridays we set aside most serious concerns and just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema. If you have any questions that you would like to ask, any information you'd like to share, do you have particular memories of any of these Games Workshop creations that you would like to bring up, or if you have experience with the Fighting Fantasy Game Book series, I know these were near and dear to a lot of folks growing up, write in. We would love to hear from you and potentially read those messages on a future episode of Listener Mail. Thanks, as always, to Max and JJ for producing, editing, and splicing everything together here on Stuff to Blow Your Mind. And yeah, if you want to reach out to us, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.